I didn't come to that school to provoke those people. I didn't come to that school to get, you know, death threats and tires slashed and fucking little bombs and shit put on my door. I didn't come to school for any of that, but I wasn't going to run from any of that. You know what I'm saying? Like, there was no part of me when I was going through whatever I was going through that I was like, oh, I should, you know, seek help from police or I should transfer. Like, that's what's so crazy. Like, none of that time I was going through that shit did I ever entertain leaving that place.
Maladjusted Life Podcast, James Murray here. Today is a real treat. Today, my guest is Kiese Layman. Kiese is the author of Heavy, an American Memoir. I had the honor of interviewing Kiese about 3 years ago for the Arkansas Times, for the Arkansas Literary Festival back in 2016. And he left quite an impression on me. So I remember at the end of the interview, I asked him what his next project was, and he said he was working on a memoir called Heavy. So here we are coming full circle. Kiese, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, James. I appreciate it.
No worries. I think one thing that anyone who reads what you write is that one thing they know about you is that you wear Mississippi on your sleeve. You let people know you're from Mississippi. And as a black man from the South, from Arkansas, I can definitely, a black writer at that, I can definitely respect that. At the beginning of Heavy, there was a part where you're having a conversation with your grandmother. And you asked her if white folks got on her nerves so much down there in Mississippi, why didn't she leave and go to, say, the Midwest like the rest of her family did?
Mm-hmm.
And she said that, she essentially said that because, you know, this land was all that she knows, right? She had put a lot of blood and sweat into that land. And what exactly do you think about the need to claim places that haven't necessarily been the best places to live for black folks?
Right.
But they put so much, I guess, blood and sweat equity into places that they feel the need to stay. Because I feel like that's true even for your case, you going up to Poughkeepsie and returning back to Mississippi. How would you describe that relationship between needing to go somewhere else and, well, wanting to go somewhere else and feeling the need to be in a place that you have, I guess, the weight of history there?
Yeah, you know, it's weird. Like, I didn't really understand until the last 3 or 4 years, like, why I was born in the South. And really, I was born in the South because my grandmother, unlike the rest of the people in her family, understandably, didn't run. You know, she didn't leave. And she was one of few who did not leave and go up to Indianapolis, Detroit, Racine, Chicago. So, you know, and she didn't leave. She's very adamant about not leaving because she was like, this is home. You know, I worked hard on this land from the time I was 5 years old. That's what she says. And, you know, she created cultural customs there. She created traditions. She stepped into traditions. So my grandmother is a black woman from Mississippi who really does love her particular part of Mississippi. You know, she's very critical of, you know, white supremacy and white folks around Mississippi, but and around where she lives. But for me, you know, I love Mississippi. I wanted to go to college in Mississippi. I got kicked out of college. A lot of bad things were happening. So eventually I had to leave. But when I left, a few years after I left, I really wanted to come home. And I got to a point up in New York where, you know, just the air I was breathing, the, you know, just the the culture which I was a part of was so far removed from the place that made me, which was Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And I just needed to get closer to home. I needed to get closer to home and to finish that book heavy. But also I just needed to get closer to home to sort of like breathe differently, to rejuvenate myself. Now, the paradox is that Mississippi's still Mississippi. So, you know, it wasn't like I was coming home to a place that was going to be easy to live. But something that is easy is that, like, when I come home, you know, black, white, you know, indigenous, whatever, like everybody down here has home training. You know what I mean? Meaning that, you know, you see people on the street, people going to speak to you. They're going to talk to you. They may hate your ass, you know, or hate who you are, what you represent. Mm-hmm. But there's a commitment to like home training, which in some way, you know, doesn't mean much. But when you up in New York and, you know, you looking at people and they look down and people don't talk to you, or they more likely to talk to dogs than they are to people. I mean, that's just a little bit of what I wanted, you know, what I wanted to come back to. And, you know, there's just the traditions, man. Like, I'm from Jackson particularly, and real talk, like what Jackson is doing in the world right now, attempting to do in the world right now, is amazing. So I wanted to get closer to that particularly. And so I live like 2 hours from Jackson now because I work at the University of Mississippi.
Right.
And I needed to finish my book, and I needed to get closer to the culture that made me. So that's why I came back.
Okay. Yeah. Jackson is doing some phenomenal things out there. They're doing a lot for a city and a state with very few resources. Much respect. And reading heavy, it's very apparent that your grandmother is a rock in your life, a very solid foundation. And there was, in the book, there's an incident where she drives you over to the white family's house that she works for, I guess when you were a teenager.
Yeah. I was 12. I was like 12. Yeah.
Okay.
Almost. Yeah.
And she goes to pick up the clothes, and the white kid is out there trying to get to know you and being annoying. You know, she takes the clothes back to the house to wash them. And before she gets to it, you kind of, I guess, run your feet and, you know, legs all through them. and you know, you guys have a conversation, and she tells you, like, you know, she's not really worried about what these white folks think about her. You know, I'm trying to put food on the table. I'm trying to help take care of my family. And she said she whipped you because, like, she's not going to have that kind of, it wasn't necessarily because of what you did to the clothes, it's because of what you were, I guess, the behavior you were engaging in her kitchen.
Right.
Right. I guess my point is, like I said, my being in Arkansas, like, my family comes from the Arkansas Delta, and my grandma did the same thing. What exactly do you think, I guess, outside of feeding the family? Well, I mean, what else do you think kind of just motivated, gave your grandmother like the willpower to just and kind of endure those kinds of things from people? The talk, the looks, the condescension. What else do you think? What do you think helped her get through that?
Man, that's a big question. I mean, I'll start by saying, honestly, like, even after, you know, being my grandmother's grandchild for 44 years now and interviewing her and talking to her, I honestly don't know really, but I can tell you what I think, but I don't know. Part of it, honestly, dude, is like, my grandmother has a belief in what I would call like the radical Christ that I have never seen in anybody else in this earth. Like, she really believes, you know, that whole mantra, you treat people the way you want to be treated. She believes that, she lives it. She believes, you know, people are like, oh, this person will give you the last thing on their plate. She'll give you her last dime. She really is somebody who believes that. Right. But she also believes that if you cross her, you're going to have hell to pay, not in the form of God or anybody else, but her. And so that, like, will to share, that will to care, and also that will to not be thoroughly disrespected, mm-hmm. is part of why she's able to really, you know, be alive today. Like, you know, she's in her 90s. She's got really bad diabetes. She's suffering from dementia. But, you know, she's got that thing, man. Like, her heart, she just wants to live, and she wants to watch, and she wants to share, and she wants to care. And a lot of that, you know, for better or worse, comes from her understanding of not just Christianity, but again, what I would call like the radical Christ, right? Like, my grandmother, you know, I've never heard her say one critical, nasty word about people who weren't Black other than white folks. You know, she's never talked bad about Mexican folks. She's never talked bad about Muslim folks. Like, she really believes that, like, we're all here to share this world together. And she's really critical about abusers of power. She doesn't want to be an abuser of power herself. And I think, like, that sort of belief, real talk in, like, the power of goodness, which is different than a belief in goodness, is part of why she's still alive and part of why, like, you know, her children are all teachers. Like, all of us in some way are teachers. You know, I think that has a lot to do with her belief that, like, we were here to love, to care, and to share as best we can. But if you cross us, it's not good. It's not going to be a good thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's, we all are my grandmother's children or grandchildren. And we don't do well when people intentionally attempt to harm us when we wouldn't do that to them.
Yeah.
And when it's like that, we got to do everything we can to get you.
Right. Yeah. I can definitely see that. I notice your Facebook post from time to time. You go hard at some folks, man.
I go hard every now and then, bro. But sometimes I go hard. Just I'm trying to plan. You know, I'm trying to just let people know that I'm about to go hard. Like on Facebook, what I do is a lot of times, like, you know, if I'm trying to, you know, critique an institution or blah blah blah, I'm just letting them know, yo, you need to change such and such, or I'm gonna try to blow you out with some essay or some article. And I did that this morning, actually. You know, I don't know, man. Like, I'm flawed, and I'm a terrible person too at times, but like, I try hard as I can not to hurt people who would not hurt me, you know, and not to harm. I mean, that's hard when you especially believe in systemic violence, which I believe in, but you know, a lot of times, man, people just out here hurting people who would never, ever hurt them. And that's just not, I mean, and we're all that person at different times, you know what I'm saying? So my grandmama just taught me that, like, we need to acknowledge when we are that person who was abusing people, but also when we are people who are, you know, people are abusing or attempting to abuse, or if we see people being abused, you got to use everything at your disposal to fight that. And for better or worse right now, like, one of the things I have at my disposal is my art. So I'm always going to try to use my art to hold myself accountable and hold institutions accountable if I can.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a motif and heavy about abuse, how we abuse one another by lying to one another, withholding truths, and holding on to those truths for so long, you know, that you know, the weight of them is, as your book so aptly puts it, is heavy.
Yeah. You know?
I think one thing I wanted to talk about is your mother and father. I'm kind of going in on family right now in the book, but your mother and father, you know, your mom being a scholar, I imagine that put your mom being a scholar who encouraged you to write and constantly revise, you had a lot to live up to. I know she was well respected in the community. And then I'm thinking about your dad. Your dad had, I know there are a few times in the novel where he talks about, in terms of his politics when it came to Black people, he was very into kind of a, and correct me if I'm wrong, kind of like a kind of a do for self mentality.
My father was, he was in the Republic of New Africa. Yeah, you're right. You're definitely right. And he believed, early in, like, kind of like self-determination. And he was one of, you know, he's part of this group who believed that if we could somehow buy Texas or make, like, Texas, like, this Black Republic, like, yeah, Black people ultimately had their own land, water, every schools, we would be better. So yeah, at the root of it was definitely like a kind of nationalistic do for self mentality, for sure.
And so with your mom, I'm seeing, you know, scholarship, community organization. With your dad, I'm seeing kind of a more, taking a more economic stance, kind of going back to the whole Du Boisian Booker T. Washington debate, right? That's the bifurcation I see between you and your parent. I mean, both of your parents. And there was something that your dad said to you about your writing that kind of hit close to home for me. As he mentioned that, you know, about you writing about white people thinking you're going to change them. And that, you know, this writing essentially doesn't mean anything. We need to own X, Y, and Z.
That was actually my mother's partner, boyfriend at the time. But he and my father had similar politics, though, for sure.
Okay. How do you think those two philosophies kind of shape your view of, I guess, of how you view Black America in terms of where we are and what we need to do and how that manifests in your writing?
Oh man, that's a great question. You know, the thing with like the Black men that I grew up sort of who were like either fathers or father type figures is that they all seem to have a belief. I mean, I'm gonna talk about the thing that I want to give them credit. Like, they helped me understand that so much of what we must work with and through as Black folks in this country is economic, right? Like, they didn't want me to run away from the economic realities of what it meant to be descendants of people who were brought here ultimately as property, and what it meant ultimately to have conceptions of freedom but not own anything. So I will say, like, they helped me understand more like the economic lengths of sort of like the suffering that I think the nation has put upon us. But my problem, and I try to get at this in the book, is that while pointing out, like, you know, our failings as Black people to what we needed to do as Black people, a lot of these men rarely seem to turn that oh so perceptive light on themselves, right? It wasn't like, oh, it was like Black people are doing wrong often because Black people don't agree with me. And I'm like, okay, but like, what if you turn that light on yourself? Like, maybe you can talk about your investments in terrorizing other women who are usually Black, terrorizing other young people who are also Black. And so what I was trying to do in that book is show that, yes, like, all, I mean, there's a huge economic threat running through that book from the beginning, where, you know, my mama has quarters, you know, dripping down into a catcher in Vegas. You know, like, we don't, you know, my mother, it looks like professionally rich because she's a professor, but like economically, we didn't have any money. One, because they didn't pay her much money at Jackson State, and also because she just was bad with money all the way through till, you know, long story shorter, when I become a professor and, you know, I'm giving my money to my mom, I'm having to decide if I'm going, you know, partake in illegal activities to make more money. Right. And then I ended up giving all my money away at casinos. So I'm trying to say, like, the economic, I understand that the economic threat that a lot of these men were trying to like instill in me is crucial. But I also think there's ways we can critique our lack of economic mobility, critique the shape of that economic lack of mobility, but also critique ourselves for investing and harming people in ways that make it hard for those people to live happily, but also live as economically like secure people. You know what I mean? I think if you are punishing or abusing someone, you're not just hurting their body. You're also hurting a lot of times like their ability to be mobile. Like, you're hurting their ability to work effectively too. You know what I mean? Saying so without being like too heavy handed, I was trying to create a book that at least like held all of those, you know, sort of like contentious points of view that run into one another. But at the root, I'm just trying to say, all these nationalist Black men, we would be in a better place if these nationalist Black men actually looked at themselves as critically as they looked at the Black communities that they were critiquing.
There's a one particular part of the book that probably stood out to me more than anything, was your time at Millsaps. I'll say this, having been a young black man at a predominantly white liberal arts college in the South, I felt like you were writing this directly for me.
Yeah, what school did you go to?
I went to Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas.
Oh, yeah, Hendricks. Yeah, I know Hendricks, yep.
And, you know, you went through this stuff, well, I guess, in the early to mid-90s. I'm hoping I'm not dating you too much. Is that?
Yeah, that's it.
That's about right, around that time. So I went through some of these exact same things. This is like, I was there 2004 to 2008. And some of the things you were writing there, like, I could just put my life in the same terms, my experience at Hendricks in the same terms. And this, that would have been, over a decade from, or at least a decade from your experience. Right. And you have some of these things going on today, at colleges and universities, but I guess to be more specific, I think one thing that, and I'm not sure if this was at Millsaps, it may have been before Millsaps as well, but you talk about when it came to academics, kind of professors being a bit, I guess, leery of you and other black folks' academic ability. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I definitely experienced the same thing. I found it weird that I can go to a school like that. And by the way, like Hendricks, and I imagine Millsaps is the same way. I mean, the academic rigor at these schools is like, it's incredible. It's incredible.
World class
education for sure. But I found it amazing that I could, you know, one could be sitting in a philosophy or history class and, you know, you're the only brother in the class, and also you're the only one talking and raising questions and everything like that, and still have your intelligence be suspect. But outside of the questioning of black intelligence, you mentioned stuff like I guess what we call now what ghetto parties that the frats used to do, things like
that. Oh, right.
Yeah, right. But I think the one thing I related to the most from your time at Millsaps, when you said you were writing for the paper, the student paper.
Yeah, I was one of the editors in the paper. Yeah,
the opinion page editor, I imagine.
Uh huh.
And I was the same thing at Hendricks. And
wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, I was the same thing at Hendricks in my freshman year. I wrote this little screed about them actually not wanting the school to be diverse as it could be. And man, the threats that I received,
man,
it's kind of people had this kind of love it or leave it mentality, you know?
Right. yeah, bro.
And the thing about in my case is that, you know, this is like 2004. So people are a bit more digital with it, right? I'll get the emails. You know, no one was bold enough to really say it to your face. You know, they're just like,
right,
give you side looks, send you emails and whatever. But you, on the other hand, I felt like, yeah, like you were in physical danger.
Yeah.
What was life like at that time when you were writing these things and, you know, being around campus? Like, what was your mentality at the time?
Bruh. There's a lot in that, man, and I'll give you the short version, but the short version is that, you know, when I came to college and even all the way through grad school, I had that thing my grandmother has. I want to tie this to something you asked earlier, which is like, if it wasn't hard, I felt like it wasn't anything I needed. You know, I didn't feel like I was worthy of anything if it was easy. Yeah. And so I'll say that, like, I didn't come to that school to provoke those people. I didn't come to that school to get, you know, death threats and tires slashed and fucking little bombs and shit put on my door. I didn't come to school for any of that. But I wasn't going to run from any of that. You know what I'm saying? Like, there was no part of me when I was going through whatever I was going through, that I was like, oh, I should, you know, seek help from police, or I should transfer. Like, that's what's so crazy. Like, none of that time I was going through that shit did I ever entertain leaving that place. Partially because it was the first time in my life I've been, like, quote unquote, free, you know, free of my house, my mom. Mm-hmm. And also partially because I was like, I'm not going to run away from these motherfuckers. Like, I'm not, you know. But yeah, you know, fam, like, the hard part about I just want to talk about one part of it, and we can talk about the larger part if you want. But mm-hmm. one of the hard parts for me was that, like, I came to school, you know, I played basketball in high school, basketball and football. I came to Millsaps really looking forward to playing basketball. I gained a lot of weight over summer. My first semester at college, I gained a ton of weight, but I would still play ball with some of these dudes. And then it's so weird to play ball. Like, ball was just so intimate. It was such an intimate thing. And, like, to play ball with some of these white dudes, and then, you know, at night, or, you know, a few weeks later, you see them in, like, Confederate capes and, you know, Afro wigs, or you see them laughing with people in Confederate capes, blackface, and Afro wigs. And I was just like, yo, how you gonna play ball with me and then either wear this gear that sanctions black suffering and terror, or actually support people who do? So, you know, I don't like to admit this, but there's a part of me that every time I saw that, like, I see that from, you know, from white brothers who, you know, we dapped each other up. Like, we shared time and space on the court. And this is an example of what I was saying. Like, they were doing things to us. And not just to, you know, black students who were there, but to our mothers and our grandmothers and our grandfathers, and, you know, that we could never and we would never do to them. And so you asked me what it felt like to go along campus. Yeah, it sucked to have, you know, your tire slashed. It sucked to have people threaten to kill you. You know, I got a gun for all of that. But the part that really made me feel emotionally, like, fucking, like, unsettled was the fact that, like, there were these people who would presumably act like we were friends when we were playing ball. But then at night, when they went back to their frat parties and all that shit, like, you know, we were niggas to them. And that shouldn't have been surprising, but it was. Yeah.
I definitely have to say, man, you know, I graduated from Hendrix, what is it? Now it's 11 years ago. And I have to say this, I still feel like I'm healing from some things that happened back then.
Right.
Like racial incidents. And I don't know. Some people may describe it as bitterness, and maybe I am. But I don't know. It was just really wonderful to know. I guess it's bittersweet, I'll put it that way, that I wasn't the only one going through the kind of things I was going through, particularly because of what one writes. Can you?
That's real, man. Have you? Do you write through that in your work?
My kind of writing is, I don't know. I'm not really writing about that anymore. I do write about racial stuff, but not necessarily about, like, particular instances or anything like that, but yeah, I would like you to read something of mine, that I can send to you once we get off the,
okay. Off this, I'd love to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. Another thing about Heavy that sticks out to me is just how your mother used writing in your life, right? Like, when she would send you over to, I guess, one of your friend's house, you had an assignment to do, she'd make you write a sentence over and over to get the point across. Like, how much do you owe? I don't want to be too presumptuous of this, but about this, but how much do you owe your writing career to your mother?
Oh, every bit, 100%. That's why, like, you know, again, you know, when you write an article or essay or a book, you know, like, you know, if you, I mean, depending on the kind of writing you're trying to do, you sometimes want readers to make connections themselves. But yeah, if you read this book, or anybody reads this book, you don't understand that one of the reasons that I'm so indebted to my mother is because she made that book possible. Like, I just would never have been able to read and write at all, but definitely with like the sort of ferocity that I kind of can write with when I'm focused without my mother. I mean, she taught me how to read. She taught me how to write. She taught me how to revise. She taught me, you know, this as a writer, man, we don't even talk about how important physically being able to be still and with your thought. I mean, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, we laugh, but that shit is hard. You know what I mean? Like, if you're not trained to just be fucking still and keep coming back to that stillness, I mean, that's one of the reasons I think a lot of, like, dope people don't choose not to write. Because it's fucking hard, my brother, like, just to be still and confront a blank space or a blank page or whatever. And it's hard sometimes to come back to that blank page and fill with words and try to, like, you know, shape those words into something that's resonant for you and for somebody else. All of that is completely, completely 100% due to my mama's training. And what I'm trying to say in that book is that some parts of it are bittersweet. You know what I'm saying? So like the same sort of like tenacity that I brought to my writing when I was writing my best, that sort of like compulsiveness is what I brought to like fucking gambling. You know what I'm saying? It's also what I brought to fucking eating. It's also what I brought to starving and exercise. So I don't think my mama made me kind of have like this compulsion or like, prone to like, I don't do drugs or drink. Because I know if I like that shit, I'm not going to stop. So like, I might have been born with like, like most people, like, you know, with sort of the capacity to be compulsive. But my mother created a writing like path for me to take that compulsion and like commitment or focus on, you know. So she's responsible for all of anything good that happened to me because of my reading and writing. It's my mama. Like, it's definitely my mama.
Nice. I remember asking you this question about 3 years ago when I was interviewing you about how to slowly kill yourself and others in America. You were taught at the beginning of that collection of essays, you wrote about wanting to commit suicide at 32. I think that was the very first question I asked you during the interview. And I think that, if I'm not mistaken, in Heavy, it comes up.
Mm-hmm.
It comes up too. As intimate as this book is, because you reveal a lot of stuff in this book, but I imagine like writing about like having suicidal thoughts, especially being, you know, in our community, it's something really difficult to talk about. But like, how did you become free to just write about having those kind of thoughts? Like, what allows you to be so free to have to express your thoughts about feeling them?
Yeah, I mean, you know? That's a great question, because I think it asks us to think about like the writing process. So like, one of the reasons I'm still alive and, you know, hope to be alive as long as my body will allow me is because I write every day, I journal. So I was writing through a lot of that stuff to myself. And so your question makes me think about what gave me the strength or power or whatever to put it out. Mm-hmm. I was teaching and I was listening to a lot of kids come talk to me about, you know, wanting to hurt themselves, suicidal ideation. Lots and lots and lots of like, you know, generations of like drug abuse and shit in their families. And I wasn't equipped or educated enough to deal with those things the way I should have. Mm-hmm. You know, what I should have said often when those kids were talking to me was like, you know, there's a counseling center over there. I can walk you over there if you want. But, you know, I sit there for fucking hours, bro. I was just trying to be the teacher that I never had. But then at some point I was like, yo, I'm talking to all of these kids about like their desires to live or die. And, you know, they get the impression that like everything with me is all good. You know, like they would never believe that like beneath the surface, you know, here I am trying to run myself to death at times, trying to eat myself to death at different times, you know, having guns to my head at different times. And so I was just like, if I'm going to be a writer, and I'm going to be serious about this writing thing, I need to be honest about the different times in my life when I didn't want to really be here. But also much more importantly, the different times in my life when I heard voices or read art or talked to people who helped me realize that everybody in this world at different times does not want to be here, fam. Like, mm-hmm. everybody. Mm-hmm. And different people find different ways to stay. And I'm not saying people should, but like, I'm glad they do. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm glad that people can find love in art or love in actual human beings or love in like memory to keep them going, you know? And I just wanted, so as important as it was to me to tell people that I, you know, had a history of trying to harm myself, it's much more important for me to talk about the things that like sort of helped me get through that. You know what I'm saying? And, exactly. and the fact that we take that with us all the time, you know what I'm saying? Like we different days where I'm like, fuck y'all, I don't really want to wake up. But like, why am I waking up? I'm waking up because of like the love of my grandmother, the love of my mother, the love of my students, the love of wonderful parts of my state. And I just know that like, I don't want to normalize our desire to hurt each other, but I think it's important for us to verbalize the fact that we have all at different times wanted to harm ourselves, and also to think about why we still are here and what not just brings us pleasure, but what actually brings us joy, the joy to want to keep going. And that's what I was trying to do, you know, with my work, but also in that book particularly, because I just think there's a whole lot of different ways you can try to hurt yourself, you know? And what I wanted to show was like, you know, one way for me was starving. Like, I mean, I literally like, you know, I wanted to faint. I wanted to get as close to death as I could. And that was actually the closest that I've been. Another way is eating too much.
Exactly.
You know, and I don't think we put those in conversation with one another enough. So that's what I was trying to do.
Yeah, man. And to me, it's always meaningful hearing about, for me, Black men talk about those kinds of thoughts. I think that, like, again, like suicide in Black community is something that we sweep under the rug. And I know in the past decade or so, there have been, there's this phenomenon, or I don't know if it's a recent phenomenon, maybe people are just starting to pay attention to it more now, but of a Black male suicide.
Right.
I'm thinking like of the iterations I've heard of that in my life. I mean, you hear it all the time, and you hear Black men talk about suicide all the time in popular culture, if you think about it. I mean, from Lil Wayne to Biggie back in the day, you know?
Yeah.
People forget that. And it's like, wow, this is really pervasive.
But that's important. Can I just say, like, one important, I just think, mm-hmm. you know, in all of our critiques about hip hop and, mm-hmm. you know, whether it glamorizes this or that, I mean, dude, the first person, Black person I heard really, really talk about suicide was Scarface back in like 89, mm-hmm. 89, 90, actually probably 90, maybe 89, 90. And on Mine's Playing Tricks on Me, you know, like that was the first time I heard the words depressive, suicide, bipolar, you know what I'm saying? Like schizophrenic, like all of these words that we use now, thankfully, like he was using back in the day. And that, you know, that helped me, fam. Like, I ain't gonna front. I mean, it helped me because I was like, oh, like, this dude feels some kind of way about being seen the same way I do.
Notice in the book, what's her name? Abby Claremont?
Yeah.
Yes. She was talking to you about being depressed.
Right.
And I noticed, I guess, I'm not sure how old you were at the time. I guess
like 16,
17, something like that. And I guess at the time, like from the way you were expressing it in the book, you seemed to have a hard time making a distinction between just a profound form of sadness and depression, which she said she was experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question is, I guess at that stage in your life, outside of, I guess outside of the issues with your weight, had anything just really, really just made you just of what you could describe now as depressed?
I mean, honestly, fam, like, that's the thing. That's one of the reasons I included that in the book is, like, I'm still not sure. I still don't know about the lines between, like, extreme sadness and depression. You know, I don't know if sometimes when I don't want to wake up, if that's because I'm sad and or if, like, sadness is always a part of depression, but depression isn't necessarily part of sadness. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, you know, man, I mean, the thing that made me the saddest or the most depressed when I was a kid wasn't just my weight. It was my relationship with my mother.
Yes.
And it wasn't just because of what she was doing to me. It was because of what was being done to her and what was being done to both of us. Mm-hmm. And really my inability or our inability to talk about it. You know what I'm saying? Like seeing your mom or seeing the result of your mom get beaten up and then hearing her have sex with the guy who beat her up. I'm not saying that that's the worst thing in the world, but it definitely is like something that you don't know. I didn't know what the fuck to do with my brain or my body in that situation. You know, seeing other friends get sexually assaulted and then also wondering why those men didn't choose me. That's not, you know what I mean? That contributes to a particular kind of depressiveness and sadness. And also just looking at the world, like this is the thing, you know, Baldwin talks about like, you know, one of the consequences of becoming conscious is that you become conscious. Like you actually become, you start to feel everything around you and you see how connected, like the suffering of fucking like cows and dogs is connected to the suffering of trees and the suffering of trees is connected to the suffering of actual like vulnerable human beings. And so I'm just saying like once you start to read and you become aware, you see joy everywhere, but you also become particularly attuned to the suffering of everything around us. And so I don't know if the weight stuff was like a consequence or byproduct of my like becoming super conscious of the way suffering was being manifested all around me. Do you know what I'm saying? Like the weight was just like the consequence of it all, not like it didn't precipitate it, you know?
I guess where was I getting it? I'm sorry, I'm actually flipping through your book right now.
Oh, okay.
I'm actually flipping through your book right now. what do I want to get at? So when it comes to I asked you this question a few years ago too, and I kind of want to bring it up again because again, I think it's something I can relate to somewhat about being a Black writer and particularly how working class Black folks view writing as a career or a passion. I've seen, in reading Heavy, you see just that kind of pushback from some of your family members, whether it be you in writing or you in academia. Like, I think it was like maybe been one of your I may be getting the family relationship wrong, but like maybe one of your uncles telling you to get a real job or something like that.
Mm-hmm. my grandmama, I mean, I left grad school because my grandmama was telling the whole family, she was like, damn, is Key ever going to get a job? And I just care. So I was in grad school. I technically had a job. I was teaching for pennies. You right. know, when you're in grad school, you got to teach for
your TA.
Right? Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. So, I was getting paid. I wasn't getting paid enough to really help my family. But when she said that, I just felt so shame. Mm-hmm. So I went and got a job, you know, a teaching job, a real teaching job, because she was like telling the family she was, you know, she was like, damn, he going to be in school forever. I was like, yeah, you know. So.
But and I think that kind of mentality kind of goes back to the whole the economic thing we were talking about at the beginning of the program, where that that the economic aspect of Black life, of particularly Black folks, descendants of slaves, right, can be in conflict, or can be in conflict with, say, loftier goals,
right,
that don't necessarily have a great monetary benefit, or at least not immediately. And so I think sometimes working class Black folks, they just kind of can't see, like, when you're in a career like academia, or you're out here pushing out novels and pushing out a collection of essays and memoirs, like, you're in it for the long haul, you know, and you're not necessarily, and that there may be some people out there doing it just for the money, but I don't know why they would do that to themselves.
No, I don't know either. And there's a whole lot of other ways.
Yeah. But I mean, you're not really in it just for the money. I mean, the money, if you're lucky enough, the money may be good at some point, but you're not in it for the money. And I've always had a hard time articulating that to my family. They just really, really don't get it. They just don't. I mean, they're working class folks. Again, from Arkansas Delta. Children of sharecroppers. Yeah, they don't get it. And I'm like, as I've grown older, I kind of realize that's something that I'm just going to have to make peace with.
Right.
I'm going to have to make, because otherwise it was just like, I'm always going to be looking for this kind of validation from them. And you want validation from your family, some sense, but it's just not going to happen because it's just not part of their world. And I have to learn to accept right. that. And this kind of reminds me when I started talking to you about a few years back, when I talked to you about that, getting that external validation from people, how important that was to you.
Man, that, can I just say, I mean, you know what's weird? When you said that, this is the first time I've ever really, wow. Like, when I was in grad school, or even when I first started writing, you know, when I got my first job out of grad school at Vassar, I never connected, like, my art with, like, like money making, which is weird. Like, I never thought, like, I wanted people to read my work, but I never was like, I want them to read my work so I can have a lot of money. But the internet wasn't popping like it is now either. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. We didn't, this was a time when, like, when you thought about essays, you thought about them being read in somebody's hand. You know what I'm saying? Like, the notion that you could write an essay and, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people could click on it and it'd be read was just some shit we just had never thought about. So I didn't really start thinking about, like, how to really monetize this stuff until the internet. And then when that came, I mean, when I, not came because internet had been around, mm-hmm. but like 2008 or seven or something like that, I started a blog, and then I was like, oh, okay. Like, a lot of people, or a good number of people for me then were reading it. And then at that point I was like, huh, I wonder if I keep doing this, could I get paid, you know, not ludicrous amounts of money, but like, could I get paid to do this, you know? And now, you know, that I'm actually getting paid, like, decent money for my art, it does seem weird, because it wasn't even something that I ever really took seriously until, like, real talk, like 4 years ago was the first time in my life I was like, oh, wow, like, I could really make good money off of this stuff. Like, so, like, for 40 years or, you know, for 30-some years, the idea of making good money off of writing was just never something. Because I was a teacher, too. You know, that's how I ate. That was where my check came in.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I can even, and right now, I can tell you on one hand the number of Black writers I know who eat well just off of their writing. Like, and I know a lot of writers, but most of them got, you know, they got second gigs, man, because shit, this thing ain't going to, you know, you know.
Yeah. It's tough.
It's tough, man. It's tough.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I definitely appreciate you taking your Sunday out to talk to me. Heavy is a very intense book. I can talk on it for hours, but I am going to let you enjoy your Sunday.
James, I appreciate you, man. I thank you so much. And I'd love for you to send me that piece when you get a chance.
I will, man. I will. So 2019 Andrew Carnegie Award winner for nonfiction, Kiese Layman. I appreciate you for taking some time out to speak to me.
All right. Thank you so much, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, man. Bye.
All right. Thanks. Bye.